Rima and Varsha co-wrote a novel when Varsha was 11. In the novel, various people in parts of the house and trees and stray dogs were characters. It was comic and dark and sad and hilarious, and in each chapter there was a hidden clue to the problem or mystery. The secret was that each clue was concealed by something similar to itself. A box of wonders was hidden in the cube of amazing things. A puppy with magical powers was hidden in its mother, since it had yet to be born. And a wish-granting mango hung with other mangoes on a branch of the mango tree. The story had got out of control, with plots and subplots of labyrinthine complexity, impossible to finish. For years, when Rima and Varsha would meet, they would say to each other, "How did Amruji become allergic to guavas?" Or, "Did Mad Puppy find the lost world inside Mobius or outside?" And they would burst out laughing. One of the other cousins had recently discovered the manuscript, copiously and laboriously illustrated, stuck between two of the 800 books in the drawing room. And the grandparents had been having a hilarious time rereading it with the younger grandchildren until after the news came. Now, life was forever divided into before and after. The manuscript was now in Nanaji's safe, as though fate might snatch away even this. My friend Skip told me this story when I was in California. There is a former killing ground off the southern coast of California in the Pacific Ocean. Here, the American whalers hunted and killed thousands of gray whales in the 1850s. In the 1970s, Skip said, well after the age of whaling was over, a Mexican fisherman had an encounter with a gray whale. The whale came alongside his boat and gazed at him. Looking into the whale's eye, the fisherman had a life-changing experience. Since then, the whales seemed to wait for the humans. Whenever people in boats come to that region during the calving season, mother whales and their young will approach them. People will touch them, and they seem to welcome these encounters. So, of course, we had to go there. We took a small plane down to a town in Baja California. There's quite a tourist business out there, bringing humans to the whales. Skip and my friend Molly, who studies kelp forests, went out in a small boat with a bunch of tourists. I got to practice my Spanish, and we were all laughing and having a great time, with the boat rocking wildly on a choppy sea. And then the guide yelled, "Whales!" I could see nothing. The spray from the waves was in my eyes, and I was trying to keep my balance. Then, as we got closer, the waters parted, and a leviathan surfaced, slowly, as though it had all the time in the world. I leaned over the rail. The ancient eye looked at me, a sentient, knowing, curiously gentle gaze. In that one glance, that tenuous temporal bridge between being and being, I knew my life would change. At that moment, I existed in a way I hadn't before, in the eye of a Californian gray whale. She could have destroyed us with one flick of her massive tail, but she just hung in the water, looking at us. The kids on the boat were already leaning over and touching her, and I did too. Her skin was riddled with scars and clusters of barnacles. She must have been quite old. Later, another whale surfaced close to us and blew a great long breath. The plume of moisture bloomed like a fountain, several meters into the air, soaking us. The sun came out at exactly that moment, and among the suspended water drops I saw, for a fraction of a second, a rainbow. "Congratulations," Skip said, hitting me across my shoulder blades as I gasped and choked. "Your first rainblow." This astonishing experience made me wonder. Knowing their bloody and tragic experience with our species, what moved these whales to seek us out? to be so forgiving? Was it one individual's bright idea to try to befriend the enemy? Jimmy thinks none of this is surprising. Living such long lives, some of the whales may have acquired what we call wisdom. It's rare enough in our species. And why should humans be the only ones with a sense of agency, a desire to make things better for themselves? We already know that whales have culture. Different pods of the same species have different habits and tastes in food. Here's another story. A dolphin was observed apparently assisting a young sperm whale that had lost its way in a saltwater marsh somewhere off an island in the Indian Ocean. Scientists who received the video from a fisherman said that it was inconclusive, but Jimmy has seen it. He's not one to jump to conclusions, but it supports his hypothesis that whales communicate with other species. After all, they live in an environment rich with biodiversity. Why wouldn't they want or need to communicate with other species sometimes? I tell him about how I grew up in the old house in Patna with the sunlight yellow walls. How, first thing in the morning, I'd be woken up by the mynas yelling outside the window and the parakeets in the neem trees. The pariah dogs would be waiting at the back door, ancestors of the current bossy pack. We had a parakeet with a broken wing when I was 10, and he would sit on the windowsill and scold the dogs and drop roasted chana or bits of toast for them. Ma, you would have already been up before dawn, watering the tulsi in the courtyard, and the radio would be playing in the dining room. Apart from the neighbors' conversations wafting through the open windows and the bells of the rickshaw wallahs, there were so many living creatures around us talking to each other. This is why I could believe the old stories as a child, in which animals are speakers and players. Jimmy had such a different upbringing here in the far north, and yet we understand each other so well. He, too, grew up with stories in which animals talk to humans and each other across the species gap. Some sympathies bridge the distance between cultures. Perhaps it is the same between species, and we modern humans simply don't notice. We're in the lowest level of the station. Sorry it looks like a dungeon here, but the best part is just ahead. Did my aunt work here? Her lab's upstairs, Julie said. You've seen it, one of the big rooms, empty now. But she loved it down here. She and Jimmy spent as much time here as possible, planning and arguing and observing, just past this door. A large steel door opened at the press of a metal knob set in the wall. There was a small space beyond and another steel door. The first door closed behind them with a slow hiss, and the second one opened. There was nothing beyond it but an ordinary passageway. Puzzled, Varsha followed Julie. Lights turned on as they walked into the dark corridor. There were no doors on either side, just the tunnel going forward into the dark, into the sea. This is going seaward? Julie turned, grinned. Yes. Hold your horses, we're almost there. And suddenly, they were in a broad open space filled with diffuse light that came in through transparent walls. The roof was a glass dome. It was literally a bubble at the bottom of the sea. Varsha caught her breath. There were tiny things moving in the water outside, small, streamlined silhouettes against what seemed to be a dank white ceiling. A few feet above the roof of the dome, it was suffused with a faint blue glow in places. We're under the sea ice, Julie said. She flicked a switch and suddenly the outside was lit. The floating ice above them discolored with gray-green smudges on the underside. In some places, the ice had thickened, forming extrusions that hung in the water like chandeliers. In the light, the ice crystals glittered like so many diamonds. Beyond the circle of light, the water was murky, mysterious, with small moving shadows. "Wow," Varsha whispered. Julie looked satisfied. "Never fails to impress visitors," she said triumphantly. "If you're lucky, you'll see more than a few fish or krill. We've seen a swimming polar bear, and during the spring migration, there's bowheads that always stop here. Since about 10 years ago, they've been venturing closer to the Beaufort coast. Same with belugas." Varsha looked around the observation chamber. There were desks and instrumentation around the circular perimeter. In the middle was a table with a microwave, coffee maker, and the attendant supplies. "Your aunt spent a bunch of time here," Julie said. "She and Jimmy used to joke that it wasn't fair for humans to observe the whales and other creatures. We should give them a chance to understand us. You should have seen the two of them dance around the room for the whales. The whales must think humans are deranged." She laughed. "Bowheads are wary creatures. They live over 200 years. Some of them still remember the days of the Yankee whalers, when they were nearly wiped out. So you can't blame them if they keep their distance. But they're intelligent creatures. They're curious. So some of them, it's always the same ones. They come and hang out and look at us and talk about us." "You're kidding, right?" "Only a little. Whales have a sophisticated communication system. Don't you know what your aunt was doing? Jimmy had a mission to decipher the communication system of the bowhead whale. Humans can now speak a little Gibbonese. White-handed gibbons, you know. South Asia? No? Well, more people should know about that. We're finally beginning to decode languages of other species. Whales and dolphins are hard. Their languages are likely to be more complex than ours. Jimmy was a marine biologist. Your aunt was an engineer. They were perfect for the project." "I thought she was working on alternative energy systems." "That was ongoing. She worked with a group of students at the college in Utqiagvik. There's a really good tribal college in Utqiagvik. They developed some prototypes of wind generation that can work with gusty winds in a place like this. Town's looking into it. She also... Here, let me show you." The outside lights turned off, except for the ones close to the seabed. Julie gestured to Varsha to get closer to the walls. On the seabed was an array of 2-foot-high devices that looked like Japanese fans mounted on flexible stems. They were swaying gently with the current. "Wave generator prototypes developed by Rima," Julie said. She worked on boat design, too, her unofficial project. Propeller-free boats that wouldn't injure marine animals. You should have seen her lab. There was this bathyscaphe, shaped like a squid, that used water propulsion. She used to get all kinds of junk from online auctions, naval junkyards and such. She got interested in whale communication after she went on her first boat ride with Jimmy. They would sit in this room and draw designs of all kinds of crazy stuff. Boats with flippers and wings. Did she actually build any of this? There were so many prototypes being tested and taken apart and tested again that I lost count. Afterwards, I heard they sent most of her stuff to the tribal college. They wouldn't have if she'd completed the project. If they'd lived, she and Jimmy, there's no telling how much they would have accomplished. What was he like, Jimmy? I never felt I really got to know him. I feel like that sometimes with the natives here. It makes me realize we European descendants are the newbies, that this was their home first and still is. The native resistance has been felt here, too, even though it is so far away from the action. Vincent, I can relate to, he lived for so long down south. But Jimmy, he just went down to California to study what the science of the whites could teach him and hot-footed it back here. He was quiet, thoughtful. Don't get me wrong, he could crack a joke and all, but he was a bit of an introvert. No small talk kind of guy. Passionate. Did they get to decipher whale talk? They made some headway. He'd published quite a bit on it. Their tapes and the papers they worked on are all with Vince. But you should talk to Vince or Matt. I'm just a microbiologist. Matt's focus is how land mammals are affected by climate change. Caribou, moose, polar bears, seals, and the impact of moose coming up from the south. The three of them would talk up a storm about species communication. Julie turned the lights off. In the dim natural light filtered through the sea ice, the observation room seemed a world unto itself. I just heard on the radio that bowhead whales have been spotted west of Utqiagvik, Julie said. It's early for them to be coming here, but apparently they are coming. You might get lucky. I feel her here, Varsha thought. She's here. Rima Mossi. In this place. She took a deep breath. I hope I see a whale, Varsha said, as they started back up the tunnel. As the lights grew stronger and the thin shore ice started melting back with a distressing rapidity, there came news that the whales were already on the move from their wintering areas in the Bering Strait. Vince and Tom and Irene were in Utqiagvik, where the mood was festive. I joined them later in the day. The sun was out and half the town was on the beach. The whale radio had declared that one of the whaling crews was headed back with whales in tow. At last we saw the first boat chugging toward us over the ocean, the flag waving. Vince was standing next to me and let up a great shout and everyone started yelling, "Hey, hey, hey!" It was Vince's uncle, Tom Jones, who was captain of that boat. Kids were running around shouting. It was like a festival. Then I saw the dark bulk of the whale in tow behind the boat and the red float bobbing close to it. As it came toward land, the man in the forklift drove closer to the water's edge and we moved out of the way. I couldn't see anything for the crowd for a while. And then I saw the whale's great carcass slide past me, pulled up by ropes attached to the forklift. It lay like a black mountain. Vince came through the crowds with his grandnephew, a boy of 5, on his shoulders. "It was a good catch," he said to me, smiling. He said something in Inupiaq. "That's a thank you to the whale for the gift of its life," he said. "The whale captain says that over the body when it is lashed to the boat. It was a good death. It died quickly." The whale was already being cut up. Long, black strips lined with pink blubber were being hauled off on ropes. The men worked efficiently with the triangular cutters on poles. Blood stained the white snow. There was shouting and singing. "We will eat well this winter," Marie said. Marie works at the grocery store and is Irene's aunt. That first whaling season was a bewildering time for an omnivore-turned-vegan Indian scientist raised in the subtropics and freshly arrived from California. I remember asking Jimmy when I first came to Utqiagvik, "How can you bear to eat such amazing creatures?" He just looked at me in his thoughtful, considering way and replied, "Because we are not apart. We are apart." It took me some time to figure out what he meant. Since then, I've attended many a whale carving and blanket toss and helped cut and prepare whale to feed the community. In the dead of winter, in a place still mostly only accessible by small aircraft, the sole source of fresh food is meat. And because the whale is sacred, it is never sold, only shared. I had a lot of whale that winter, parboiled and dunked into soy sauce, or cut frozen straight from the ice cellar and into the mouth. I have a lot more respect for the hunter who brings in the wild kill and says his prayers over it than for those who trap animals into constant, unrelieved suffering in their thousands in factory farms. Thus I am made of many things: mother's milk, fruit of guava and mango trees, rice of the Indian Gangetic Plain, vegetables of splendid variety, meat of many creatures, and now, bowhead whale. Next morning, Rick showed up. Varsha was in her aunt's room, folding clothes and shoes into cardboard boxes. He smiled at her from the door. "Hey, want to come for a helicopter ride?" He was charming, even if he couldn't be trusted. She should say no, but what harm was there in a helicopter ride? She was sick of this room, sick of grief. She could handle this man. She had known men like him during 3 years working in industry, before the MS program, before America. Before. She was glad not to run into anyone else as they went up to the roof of the building. "Where are we going?" "Just over the sea. Quick trip out to the nearest T-Rex and back. You're here for such a short time, you should see a little of the Arctic." On the rooftop, the cold breeze took her breath away. She stumbled. Rick steadied her, his face unreadable behind the goggles. She climbed into the helicopter, a compact yellow and black giant bumblebee of a machine, with Arctic Energy painted on the sides, the circular insignia of Gaia Corp. "You know how to fly this thing?" she yelled over the engine's roar. He grinned. "Want to inspect my license?" She shook her head. "Just get me back safe and sound," she yelled as they rose into the air. "In time for lunch." Much as I'd like to spend more time with the most attractive woman in 50 square miles, I'd fully intend to get us back for lunch, he said, laughing. "Although I could get you a better meal in Utqiagvik." "Mr. Walters, you're flirting," she said. Below them, the ice sheet was a great white wing fraying at the edges where it met the liquid sea. North Point Station had vanished behind them. "Sorry," he said. He sounded unrepentant. "Look, we're over the ocean now. Those little white patches are part of the shore ice that separated, floated off." The ocean was incomprehensibly vast, stretching away to the curve of the horizon. Above their heads, the helicopter blades were a blur through the transparent walls of the cockpit. "Why are we going to see the T-Rex?" "We've had some trouble with a couple of them. We don't know why. System failures, mechanical wear, hydrophones, non-functional. I like to reconnoiter, at least semi-regularly. Despite the big melt, the Arctic is still a really inhospitable place." "Well, I don't need to tell you that." "What kind of trouble?" "Hang on, we're here." The craft fell like a stone. Varsha clutched the edge of her seat, but the helicopter slowed and hovered over the dark sea. The tops of the waves glittered in the low-angled sunlight. She gasped. Before them, rising out of the water like a creature from a mechanized Jurassic nightmare, stood the T-Rex. It was the one she had seen from the window of her aunt's office. Its long snout swiveled toward them, and its optical sensors glittered with iridescence like the compound eyes of an insect. Rick's fingers flashed over the copter's dashboard, and the T-Rex abruptly bent its head. Its neck collapsed inward until it was several meters shorter. "It's pulling its legs in. I've put it in search mode so you can see how it works," Rick said. "Look." Floats inflated on either side of the machine. It began to move through some invisible propeller mechanism purposefully across the sea. The copter followed it. There was a deafening series of booms below them. A milky froth appeared in the water around the T-Rex. "That's the air gun array. Don't worry, I've turned it off now. Sound waves penetrate the seabed and are reflected back. See the buoys around it? Hydrophones, receiving the sound, giving it a picture of the seafloor, hundreds of meters down." "Pretty impressive," Varsha said. "But damaging to whales, I hear."
"Yes, but the T-Rex has a 360-degree sensor that detects whale pods," Rick said. "It's not just the Inupiaq who care about the whales, you know. We spend a lot of R&D money making sure we don't damage the environment." His fingers moved over the dashboard controls again. "There. It's back to doing sampling. Good. It passed the test, and you got to see it in action." On the way back, she asked him whether he'd looked at T-Rex's self-diagnostics.
"You're smart," he said, "like your aunt. The diagnostics don't tell us anything because the non-functionality comes without warning."
"It could be a kind of cascade failure," she said. "I've worked with some sophisticated AUGS programs. Complexity can cause all kinds of sudden failures." He looked at her.
"Maybe I shouldn't tell you this," he said, "but I've seen some internal reports. Problems with some of the geoengineering projects that nobody understands. Warming spikes instead of cooling in the upper atmosphere. Plankton die-offs where you expect a bloom. Winds changing in unexpected ways. We could use people like you."
"I thought you were just the transition liaison," she said, mocking him. "I didn't realize you were the CEO of Gaia Corp."
He threw his head back and laughed. The sky above them was a deep azure. Below and ahead lay the ice, swathed with the sun's gold light.
"I like you, Varsha," he said, looking at her. "I think we're going to be friends."
Rick stayed for lunch. It was an uncomfortable lunch, since the scientists didn't seem to want to talk very much. Only Carl, Julie's husband, held up the conversation. Vince was very quiet. Varsha thought uncomfortably that perhaps he felt betrayed by her excursion with Rick. She wanted very badly to reassure him. After Rick left, she gave herself time to collect her wits and went to talk to Vincent. He was in his office, packing boxes, sat on the floor and on chairs. Vincent had his back to her, looking at a large map on the wall. But when she came into the office, he turned, although she hadn't made any sound.
"About my copter ride with Rick Walters," she said. "I wanted to let you know. He was all charm, but I didn't tell him anything. He showed off his T-Rex and brought us back, that's all. I wouldn't let Rima down in a million years."
Slowly, he smiled. "It's been very tough," he said. "The last year and a half, it's been one thing after another. It's not for me to tell you what to do, but thanks for being smart about Rick Walters."
"What is it that he wants to know, anyway? What are we hiding from him?"
"Rick's an information gatherer," he said. "He collects all kinds of details indiscriminately, in the hope that they will come in useful someday. That's kind of how he swung the deal for North Point. In short, he's nosy." He pointed at the map. "I unrolled it and put it back on the wall after he left, just to look at it again before I pack it away. It's Rima and Jimmy's work. They called it the Map of Anomalies. Rick would love to get his hands on it." It was a map of the coastline, rich with markings and symbols in a rainbow of colors. Lines traced the migration pathways of the bowheads, different shades of blue indicating how the paths were shifting every year.
Rima and Jimmy would follow the bowheads in a boat or track them with drones and underwater robots, explained Vince. Little red triangles indicated sites of killer whale attacks. Red squares were ship injuries, and red lines were T-Rex trajectories across the shallow seas. Event markers were in mysterious purple symbols. This was the most recent one, after Rima and Jimmy were lost. I put it in, just this past October, at the time of the fall whaling. These are places where Jimmy's drones picked up bowhead whales in formations that have never been seen before, sounding together. Those symbols over there are T-Rexes that malfunctioned without warning. Rick's not the only one interested in T-Rexes. Another symbol off the shore of Baffin Island in the Canadian Arctic indicated a crossing point, where migration routes of belugas, the small white whales of the north, intersected the new bowhead pathways. There were similar intersections with humpback routes in the North Pacific. It's a pattern recognition exercise, Varsha said, remembering games from childhood. I wish I could see a little of what they saw. On her third day at North Point, Varsha made a discovery. She had left the bookshelf for last. She started to make two piles on the bed, books to give to Vincent, if he wanted them, and books she would take back with her. On the bottom shelf, she found something she had given to her aunt the summer before last, a fat tome that was not a book, Adventures in the Real and the Unreal. With shaking hands, she opened it. There was her handwriting on the first page, with love from Varsha. May you have must adventures. The first few pages were real, but in the middle of the book was a hollow compartment. Inside was a small book with a red-brown cover, a diary. There were also some thin parchment-like pieces of paper carefully folded. She opened the diary first. Her grandparents had given it to Rima when she had visited them the summer before her disappearance. The last time I saw her, Varsha thought, and I didn't even know it. She remembered Nanu handing his daughter the book. I know you are too busy to keep a diary, he had said, but at least write something in it from time to time. When you think of us, write something for us. No engineering diagrams, but just what you were thinking and doing. Fill it up until your next trip home. Then bring it so we can all read it. It was less than half full. Rima's small, neat handwriting interspersed with little cartoons. The first entry. My greetings to the guava tree, the bossy pack, and the human horde of Chandragupta Park. No engineering diagrams, only deep thoughts in these pages. As promised. Right now, I am on a plane back to Alaska, but I will write more when there is something worth sharing with you all. She couldn't read any further. She set the journal down and fell to her knees and wept, with her face against the bed, hard, angry sobs. She grabbed the pillow and held it to her. Her chest hurt. I could die with grief, she thought. And close on that came the thought of her grandparents. They had survived the terrible news. How? She thought of her Nanu's face when they got the news, how it seemed to have shrunk. She thought of what he'd kept repeating over and over the first week or so. They didn't find the body. They haven't found the body. And then the discovery of the black box, the relaying of the last words, and the solidity, the incomprehensibility of grief. Her grandmother, who had seemed so fragile, suddenly appeared stronger, weeping her sorrow with a fierceness that kept them from going under. She had taken up knitting with a vengeance, the shawl she was knitting for Rima that was half complete. She took it up again. Last Varsha heard, she was still at it. The shawl was the size of a blanket by now, and growing larger as though it was possible for her grandmother to knit her way across the abyss that had opened in their lives. Even the pariah dog pack that lived in the neighborhood, the Bossies, had howled for 3 nights. Her parents, uncles, aunts, cousins, the neighbors with whom the children had grown up, all shared the burden of grief. And someone or other would keep saying, "Look, Rima wouldn't want us to fall apart. We've got to go on for her." And again, how could it be? She was the most alive person I knew. "But there's nobody I can share this with," she thought angrily. She was far away from everyone. At lunch, she asked Vincent, "Is there a gym, a track, or someplace I can run?" "There's a treadmill on the upper floor. I think it's still there. You can use it. The only gym's going to be in Utqiagvik." "You okay?" Julie, sitting next to her, gave her a quick, worried look. "I'm fine. Well, as fine as I can be anyway. I have this habit, see, of running every day. They might bring the Boston Marathon back this year, so I've been training. I get a little crazy if I can't run." Later, Vincent said, "You only have a couple more days here. I'm going home tomorrow evening. Come and have dinner with my wife and me then." She felt much better after the exercise. Back in her aunt's room, she read some more pages of the diary. She carefully unfolded the sheets of paper. They were thin but tough, like cloth. They were blueprints of some kind, but hand-drawn. There was a delicate and precise sketch of a boat. But what a strange boat! It had flippers and some kind of sail. A series of drawings showed the boat closing up from the top, like a convertible. There were other fine pages of notes and a different handwriting, presumably Jimmy's, because she couldn't understand the words. In Upiak? There were sketches of whales of various types and waveforms of sound waves. There was a list in her aunt's writing, people and research institutions around the world. A Kartik Sahe at Marine Research Labs, Chennai. A Skip Johnson at a facility in California. Others in places as far away as Finland, Siberia, South Africa. Her aunt had thought all this was important enough to hide from prying eyes. Varsha remembered Rick Walter's offer of help. "Fuck off," she told him silently. On the other hand, what did she know about Vincent? He was not a scientist. He was the coordinator for the Native Science Collaboration. They matched Native elders with scientists. Whatever for. There was so much she didn't understand about this place, these people. She was almost sure Rima had mentioned Vincent during her last trip home. She had talked about Jimmy, showed them pictures, and Vincent had been mentioned. And Julie. That was as close to an endorsement she was going to get, unless the diary provided any clues. She would probably have to trust someone eventually, but for now she would keep the existence of the diary and the papers a secret. In the afternoon, there was some excitement. Matt reported that bowheads had been seen in the waters off Utqiagvik. The whaling camps were still being set up. It was a little early for the whales to have left their wintering grounds in the Bering Sea. A couple of whales were heading east along the coast now. There was a general rush to the observation bubble on the seabed. The sun's light percolated dimly through the ice above their heads. The water was dark, washed with blue where the ice was thin enough to let in some light. Matt turned on the external lights, but very dim, so that the golden radiance allowed them to see about 10 meters further into the water. Fish swam by on the other side of the wall, their pale bellies agleam in the light. "There," Vincent said, "Akvik." and a dark mountainous shape loomed just beyond their field of vision and swam with cloud-like grace toward them. It came deliberately, straight to them, a huge 30-foot bulk with its flipper brushing the wall, its great eye looking in. In all her life, Varsha would never forget that moment when she looked into the eye of the whale. Near her, the others were talking quietly, exultantly. "She's looking well. Look at that healed propeller scar." There was another whale behind this one. The two whales took turns looking into the lighted room. There was a low, long booming sound, like a distant cello. Varsha could feel the walls vibrate. The whales were calling. They must have circled the observation dome for a good 15 minutes before moving away into the dark. "Wow," said Varsha, finding her breath. I've never seen anything like this. How do you know one whale from another?" "Marks on the fluke, the tail," Vincent said. "Are they all so curious?" "Whales are individuals," said Matt. "Most of them keep away from here, but these two, and there are three others. They stop and say hello whenever they are passing by." "We have hydrophones set up all along the coast," Julie said. "Here, I'll play the recording." She pressed a button on the computer keyboard. A waveform scrolled across the screen, and the sound filled the air. It was the strangest call Varsha had ever heard. It filled the room, filled her being. "It feels as though I ought to understand it, but I don't," she said, shaking her head. She thought of her aunt standing here, watching the whales, hearing them sing. One of my former engineering professors, who looked like the crazy prof in the movie Three Idiots, had this huge construct in his lab made from odds and ends, a Rube Goldberg machine on steroids. If you dropped a certain ball onto a ramp, the machine would light up and there would be wheels turning, pulleys spinning, weights flying into the air to hit specific targets and so on. The grand finale was that a dart would fly out and bury itself in a large picture of Isaac Newton on a styrofoam board. The damn thing made a great racket. Isaac's face was so perforated with dart strikes that his visage had mostly disappeared. We loved the machine, and part of our spare time was always spent tinkering with it. The crazy prof called it Newton's engine. I realized, when I was quite young, that there were two classes of problems, broadly speaking: simple ones and complex ones. Machines are good at solving simple problems, but throw in enough complexity and all bets are off. I went into biomimicry-based engineering because I wanted to challenge this realization. It's only when I got to the Arctic that I realized my first instinct had been right. You can't solve complex problems with machines without breeding more problems of increasing intractability. Complexity is the spanner in the works of Newton's engine. But it goes beyond that. You might think a sufficiently advanced AI would think its way through some of the failures. I happen to know they are not just rumors that are plaguing GaiaCorp's Project Terra. GaiaCorp has invested so much in its intelligent geoengineering systems, but I think it is inconceivable for autocrats to realize that their slaves might not march to their orders. AIs are a fundamentally different kind of intelligence than humans. We have more in common with the whales than with our household robots. I think our main problem may be that we think of the Earth itself like a Newton's engine, something we can tinker with and fix. Jimmy says that even biologists fall into this trap of putting living creatures into rigid categories of structure and behavior, motivated by simplistic evolutionary imperatives. To him, to understand the whale would mean not just the kind of work he did for his PhD at San Diego, but also traveling with the whale through its great migrations around the North Pole, being part of its way of being without any preconceived notions. You see things differently when you are part of them, he says. Explain, I say, and he laughs and says he can express these ideas better in Inupiaq. It is so much more precise a language. Jimmy is not a talker, not in English anyway. I think because he dislikes sloppiness. He likes to say things right. You should hear him chattering with his nieces and nephews whenever there is a big family gathering. As I take the first baby steps learning in Inupiaq, I remember what you always used to say, Papa, that every language is a different way of seeing the world.